Luke 14:25-35 was presented by Ron Julian at the 2007 Summer Institute entitled Soren Kierkegaard. The first 8 minutes of this recording have been lost. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
So I think the issue is very similar to what we were talking about yesterday with being persecuted for his sake and Jesus talking about his own death that we saw in Mark and so on. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. And I'm inclined, Jack would disagree about this, but I'm inclined to see it in the same way that I was understanding this language yesterday in the passage we looked at. The cross is the instrument that my enemies use to execute me. So to carry my cross, my own cross, is to embrace the idea that I may pay for following Jesus with my life. And that's what I think he's getting at there. I am willing to embrace the idea of my loss of everything because I'm really gaining in following Jesus. Then he tells the stories, and after the story, he says, "So therefore no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions." And I think this translation is a little misleading. To say, give up all your possessions, makes it sound like what his issue is in order to be my disciple, you have to take everything you own down to goodwill and give it to them and live in a cardboard box, not have anything. It shouldn't be your cardboard box either. You should be borrowing it from somebody because you shouldn't have any possessions. I don't think that's what he means. I do not think that, even though, yes, he told the rich young ruler to sell everything he had and follow him, I think that was a specific piece of advice to a specific person, that in general, he's not saying to us, the way of the disciple is to have no possessions. I don't think that's what he means. And the word possessions is not quite capturing the sense of this word, I think. I think it's better translated something like this. No one of you can be my disciple who does not say goodbye to all that is his own. And in this context, it's father, mother, wife, brother, children. Those are possessions. That is, they are mine. They are part of what I have. They're my support and comfort in this world. But what he started out saying is, I have to be willing to hate them in the sense of not cling to them as where my life is going to be found. So I am saying goodbye to that which is my own, including the relationships that I have. Not that I walk away from them and saying, I'm not related to you anymore, I don't want to see you anymore, but I have let go of them. I have said goodbye to them. I am following Jesus, and if you're not coming, well, then I have to say goodbye because I'm holding to this. What Jesus is calling me to is what I love, not maintaining your good will towards me if you're not going to support me in my faith. So this is an appropriate conclusion to the point that he's making here. He's not saying go sell your stuff. He's saying don't hang on to anything that you have in this life. You mean not that you're going to have to give it all up necessarily. There's much that you have in this life that you just have, and you'll continue to have it, and one day you'll die and go to the kingdom of God, and you never had to give up your iPod. You had it your whole life, and until it breaks next month, then you go and get another one. But it's not that he's saying you have nothing in this world, but I am to love nothing in this world. I am to say goodbye to it and hold it loosely. Therefore, salt is good, but if even salt has become tasteless, with what will it be seasoned? It is useless either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. I think that we should understand this in the same sense. He uses a very similar sort of statement right after the Beatitudes. We didn't exactly look at that. I think it was right after the section we looked at yesterday. But he's talking about Blessed is the one who's persecuted on account of me, because he will receive the kingdom of God. The prophets were treated in the same way. You're blessed if the world doesn't think highly of you, because the world didn't think highly of the prophets either. He's saying, and think about their reward. I mean, the prophets are going to be sitting at the table at the kingdom of God, which is where you want to be. So, you know, however the world treated the prophets, that's not a bad thing. That would be a good thing. And then he uses, in support of this idea, he talks about how a city set on a hill cannot be hidden, and then he talks about salt. And if it's not salty anymore, then it's not good for anything, and you throw it out. And I think in that context, what he's getting at is to be a disciple of Jesus means to embrace a certain distinctive thing that is at odds with the rest of the world, like the city set on a hill. You're wandering along and through the plains, and all of a sudden there's this big hill with a city on it. You can't hide it. Everybody sees it. It is so obviously sticking up there on this hill that, you know, you're stuck. Everybody's going to know that that city's there. Well, the same thing. Being a disciple of Jesus, you're going to stick out. You're going to be different than the way the world is going. And the idea of the salt is, look, the whole point of salt is not inert. Salt is not the kind of thing that you stick it in something and say, well, it won't stick out. Of course it'll stick out. If you put it in food, it will be salty. And if you put it in the ground or the manure pile, it does something. I mean, I'm not sure what Jesus had in mind there, but the point is, if it didn't do anything, then you wouldn't bother to stick it there to begin with. You'd say, oh, this salt's no good, and you'd throw it out. So the call to discipleship is a call to be distinctive, to be different, to stick out, to have that effect in the world. And that's, I think, in the context, it's very appropriate. It's just the same thing he was talking about with the Beatitudes, that idea that you have this choice. You can follow me and stick out and thus face the persecution of the world in one way or another. People are not going to like what you're about. Or else, you can be inert and bland and not stick out, and everybody will say, oh, you're one of us, you're fine, but then you're not my disciple. You're going to have to decide. You want to be my disciple and stick out, or you want to not stick out and not be my disciple? That's the choice that he's facing, and that's the choice that I face in my family. If I'm going to keep everybody happy, I'm going to have to be inert and not be any different. But that's not being a disciple of Jesus. Okay, so I can't keep everybody happy, which means that I have to face the real possibility of loss. That I'm going to have to take this risk, follow Jesus, and risk losing what it is I have in the world. Okay, so now that brings us to the story. I'll just tell you what I think is going on, and you've all been pretty nice so far, so don't jump on me too hard. But okay, first of all, when you interpret a parable, how I understand what the issue is in a parable, most of the parables at least that Jesus told, is that he's telling a story that is like something else. The idea is it's an analogy. You know, if I say, you know that time when your roommate borrowed your favorite shirt and wore it without asking your permission and spilled ketchup on it and ripped the sleeve, and then he hid it in your closet and didn't tell you, and he took your credit card out of your wallet and he went and charged some stuff and for himself and he didn't tell you. You know how you felt? That's how I felt when you say that kind of thing, and you're saying, you understand this situation, right? You know how you would feel or how you felt or what it's like to do that. That's what I'm saying this thing is like over here. That's what I understand the parables to be. Okay, and that determines, now this is controversial. There are other ways of understanding what a parable is, but so you understand where I'm coming from. That's how I understand a parable. So that, to me, is actually a very, very strong and important point, because the way you understand a parable, from my perspective, is you put yourself into the story, you live in it, you think about what's going on in this story, and then you ask yourself, okay, what is it about this story, then, that is like the thing that, that Jesus is talking about? The classic analogy, example of this is before Jesus, when, at the time of David. You remember David slept with Bathsheba, and she got pregnant, and he arranged for her husband basically to be killed in battle so that he wouldn't be discovered that he had done this. So the prophet Nathan comes to him, and he says, I have a story to tell you. There's this poor little guy, and he and his family, they have this one little sheep that, you know, this is all they have in the world. And they get, you know, it serves their wants. And then there's this rich guy who's got, you know, a jillion sheep, but he's got somebody coming over for dinner, and he says, hey, grab that poor guy's sheep. I'll use that. Okay. And David is outraged. Let's find that guy and bring him here, and I'm going to chop his head off. And I mean, this is awful. And then Nathan says, it's you. You are the man. That is, you, that story that I just told, you are the rich guy who stole the little lamb from the poor guy. And he's referring to the episode with Bathsheba. You see what happened? David put himself into the story and said, yeah, I understand what you're talking about here, the injustice, the evil that's happened. And then Nathan says, that's you. That's what you did. I think that's what Jesus' stories most of the time are meant to do. Is he's saying, there's some logic, there's something, the way you feel or your motives or something in this situation in life are like what you would do over here. So, that has determined the direction that I have gone with these stories. I have thought about these for a long time. I felt for many years that I didn't understand them. I was not happy with how I understood them. And this is of no consequence at all. I mean, this doesn't prove anything, and honestly, I don't intend it to. But I'm just speaking personally of my experience. This was a number of years ago. I've always wrestled with these parables, and I didn't get what was going on. And I was sitting and studying and thinking I might have to teach on them, and I don't know what to do with them. And all of a sudden, just in a flash, this picture of what they were saying occurred to me. Whoa. I mean, that all of a sudden it just says, that makes perfect sense to me. And I stood up and I sort of backed up against the wall, like, whoa. I mean, what was that? I mean, it was the most unusual interpretive experience I've ever had. It just sort of, now, so am I claiming revelation? Yes. So, no, I am not. But, No. But this, I have to admit, I am attracted a little bit to my idea here, because I just thought this is the weirdest thing that I've ever experienced being a student of the Bible. This doesn't happen very often, believe me. Okay, so what's happening in this story, first of all, then? Okay, very quick question: why a tower? What would that mean? Why did he want to build a tower? If we're trying to understand the story, what's at stake? It's hard to say definitively. One of the uses of a tower would be for defense of your property. You put the tower up so somebody can be up there and watch to see somebody's not getting into your fields and doing stuff that you don't want to. So a defensive, to make sure that you get to keep all your stuff, would be a use of a tower. It would be a sign of wealth. It would enrich and enhance his property to have this very obvious tower there that he clearly had the resources to build, and he has enough stuff that he would want to have a tower to be protecting things. And it's that kind of thing involved, I think. Now, what strikes me in these stories, this is where I'm going to try to paint the picture of, don't think about the theology yet. Don't think about the point that he's making, that you think he's making in the parable. Think about the story first. Let's just think about the stories as if there wasn't a point that he was making from them. What's going on in these stories, first of all? And it seems to me that both of these stories have the same sort of logic. Both the man who wants to build the tower and the king have a goal that they want to reach. The man wants to protect or enhance his wealth, perhaps his reputation among other people, that he's a successful person and that stuff. The king wants to protect and retain his rule over his kingdom. He doesn't want to be defeated by this other king. He wants to be a free agent, king over his own kingdom. Both the man and the king have a step they would like to take to accomplish these goals. The man wants to build a tower, and the king wants to go to battle with the king coming against him. Both of them think that if I can accomplish those goals, then if I can make that step and do that, then I will have successfully accomplished what I'm trying to accomplish. Both the man and the king need to stop and consider whether they can actually accomplish their goals. The man needs to consider whether he has enough resources to finish the tower. It's no good to say, I'd like a tower. If you don't have enough to actually build the tower, then wanting it isn't going to change anything. The king, we're told, has an inferior position. He has half the forces that the other king has. So he has to ask himself the question, can I win this battle? I'm going to go to battle with this guy. Can I win with half the forces he has? Now, both the man and the king need to realize that if they proceed in spite of their lack of resources, they will not reach their goal, and in fact, they're going to make things worse. Not only will the man not have a tower if he doesn't have enough to make a tower, but everybody's going to see this partially built tower that's going to sit there because he can't finish it, and instead of enhancing his reputation and protecting his stuff, everybody's going to laugh at him. Did you see this guy? He built this tower. He can't even finish it. You know? And so his situation is going to be worse than it would have been if he had not built the tower at all. And likewise with the king. In his situation, he has this choice between, I can go to battle with the guy who has greatly superior forces, or I can surrender and seek terms of peace. If I go to battle with him, I'm going to get decimated. I mean, everybody's going to die. I'm going to lose. I will have gone to battle against him and be the loser, and I will pay the full price for having done that. Whereas, I could choose instead to seek terms of peace. I say, look, let's negotiate here. We don't even have to fight, but we'll just work out, you know, how is this going to work? So, I would argue that in the terms of this story, and this is the thing I'm emphasizing, and this is different than pretty much what everybody does with these stories, it seems to me, if you wanted to capture in a nutshell in what the sense of these stories is, the sense of these stories is, give up. The point is, give up. You can't win that battle. You don't have the resources to build that tower. You're going to make it worse if you go and do this thing. You'd like to do it, but if you go to do it, you're going to make it worse than it would have been if you hadn't done it at all. So the smart thing to do is look at it, say, you know, with the first story, you might think, well, maybe he does have the resources to do it. In the second story, it's clear he doesn't. He's outnumbered. He's not going to win this battle. And I know, you know, 300 and all of that stuff, but that's not what Jesus is getting at here, I don't think. I mean, that's the, okay, we don't have to go there. All right, so. Now, see, the problem here then is, I would argue that from the story, the sense that I get is, you're an idiot if you don't have the resources to pull this off and you go to do it. That's foolish. You should give up. You should surrender. The typical way of understanding these parables is something along the lines of, the cost of being my disciple requires letting go of the things of this life. A man building a tower counts the cost before he builds. A king counts the cost before he fights. So you should count the cost before you become my disciple too hastily. But I have a couple of problems with this. First of all, I mean, you can make it work. You can kind of twist it in and say, okay, well, yeah, this works. But Jesus' point here doesn't fit anything else that I'm aware of in the New Testament. The entire thrust of the New Testament teaching is that it is time and the testing of your faith that is going to show whether you've got what it takes to be a disciple. I mean, there is no way that I could sit down and say, do I know that I have what it takes to be a disciple of Jesus? There is no way that I could answer that question. I mean, I could say, I want to, I think I want to, I think I have what it takes, but I don't think that I can really assess that, and I don't think that I'm being asked to say, before you become my disciple, decide whether you can go all the way, and if you don't think you can go all the way, don't start. I think that's really bad advice. I mean, at least, unless you kind of twist it around and you kind of tone it down. You basically just say, well, all he's really saying is there's a cost and you need to know that before you start. But then the power of the story just disappears. I mean, you know. And then the other problem is, as I say, if we weren't in advance thinking that the point is these stories have to tell me that I'm supposed to count the cost of becoming a disciple, it seems to me that the point of the story seems to be pretty clearly give up. I mean, so I would like to argue that the point of these stories is give up, and yet, in the end, the result of it is to reinforce his teaching here that I need to hate father and mother and give up all that is mine in order to follow him as a disciple. I think the thing that got me thinking along the lines that I'm thinking now is thinking about the story of the two kings. Because if you think about this story, okay, there is a king afar off. He's not here yet, but I know that one day he's coming and he's going to do battle. And I have to decide, am I going to wait till that day and do battle, or am I going to assess things now and decide I can't win that battle, I'd better surrender. If you think about it in those terms, it's not hard to see that instead of thinking about fighting the war as becoming a disciple, it's pretty easy to think about that. Well, maybe that king who's not here yet but is coming is God, is the return of Jesus. That one day he is going to arrive and then the outcome is going to be assessed. But I have the opportunity right now to think about what am I going to do? Am I going to try to resist him when he comes? Or am I going to decide, no, I'm going to surrender and seek terms of peace now? And that's along the lines that I'm thinking both of these stories need to be understood. The question that we're asking ourselves is not, do I have what it takes to be a disciple? It's, do I have what it takes to hold on to my stuff and not let go of it and think that somehow I'm going to be able to keep it and preserve my life? What's my option? If I don't want to be the salt in the world, if I don't want to hate father and mother, my option is, well, maybe I can kind of play it both ways here. Maybe, you know, okay, sure, you're God and everything, but I'm just going to lay low and I'm going to keep all my stuff and make sure that I don't ever do anything that jeopardizes any of my stuff. You know, I'm basically going to keep it from God. God, I have what it takes. I can keep this stuff. I can make a life out of the stuff that I have now. I'm not going to have to give any of this up. And I think what he's saying is, what we need to stop and reckon is, no, I don't have what it takes to do that. I cannot, out of the resources that I have in life now, the stuff that is mine, the relationships I have, the possessions I have, what I have in the world, I cannot take this and turn it into a life that will last. I cannot make for myself a life that is going to be what I want it to be. What I have to do is give up. I need to recognize that king who's coming, he's going to win. God in the end is going to prevail. And rather than try to hold out on him and keep my stuff from him, I need to recognize right now, while I have the chance, I'm not going to win. I need to give this up and seek his terms. What, you know, how would you have me deal with this stuff? Because I'm not going to have the sovereignty to deal with it myself. So I would paraphrase it, you cannot be my disciple without letting go of the things of this life. Now maybe you think differently, that you would like to keep the things of this life and be my disciple still. But think about a man who wants to build a tower to protect and enhance his possessions. If he does not have the resources, he will be unable to finish, and he will be a laughingstock. So he is much better off giving up. Think of a king who wants to win in battle against another king, but he is outnumbered 2-1. If he goes to battle, he will be conquered and destroyed, so he is much better off giving up and seeking terms of peace. You too are in the same position. You might think that you want to resist my teaching and hold on to the things of this life, but you cannot succeed. You cannot keep and protect the things of this life. You cannot preserve your independence from the king who is coming. So you too would be better off to give up the things of this life to become my disciple. That's what I think that he's saying. Now, maybe that's not right, but what I like about it is the story really speaks here. I can really see what the point of the story is, and I think it makes a lot of sense to our situation. We have a very strong temptation to think that we're going to be able to trick God into letting us have it our way in this life. And the fact is, we can't. We cannot do it. And it's better to recognize it and give up and go his way, because in the end, if you try to resist it, thinking that somehow you're going to pull it off, you're only going to make it worse. Okay, sorry, we went late. If we have a question and answer time, you can tell me where I went wrong. Okay, so it's lunchtime.